This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, Houston's hidden gem, with a developer-friendly environment and Houston's sixth-largest business center. More information at nnmd.org.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm J.R., a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us as we talk a little politics. Brandon, lots to cover here. We still got stuff going on here in the Texas legislature. We got the inaugurations.
Yeah, happy inauguration week.
Yeah, happy inauguration week. The balls and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Before we go Texas, we got to talk national shutdown drama, shut down many of the biggest. Donald Trump likes to do the things bigger than anyone else. He's accomplished that with the shutdown. We joke about it, but there's 850,000 people and folks associated with it that are in desperate shape now.
Absolutely. This is the longest shutdown, as you said, in U.S. government history. I think that we're talking about some important political things here. I mean, I think for one, the White House, I think, could get better leverage on this, but isn't. I mean, the president's bully pulpit's pretty big, but he's on every side of the issue, right? He's sort of said he's going to hold firm on the border security package and then says maybe he's going to negotiate. He says he wants to talk about DACA, but then wait for the courts. At the end of the day, I think that the White House is getting part of what they want, right? They're getting a constraint on government, but it's going to come at a pretty high price, and I think that's going to be a potential problem going forward.
The human toll on the individuals individually affected is dramatic already. We're talking about people having to go to food pantries, people working,
right,
not getting paid, not making their mortgages. It's a huge issue, and I think just the politics of it are terrible for the president. His disapproval rating is climbing. He's now well below 40% in terms of approval in every major poll. He's sinking like a rock, and there's no end in sight because, frankly, there's no path forward because they are, both the Democrats and the president seem to be almost inextricably sort of deadlocked in what they want to do.
Right.
Brandon, speaking of deadlocked, we just take a quick little jaunt across the pond, as they say, as the Brits say. We think we're messed up in the United States. They are showing us the way forward on how to be dysfunctional.
Right, right. The original dysfunction, right, comes from them, right?
That's
We're simply borrowing as a colony, right?
Right. Well, Brexit, the United Kingdom's attempt to leave the European Union, has basically turned into just a clown show over there. Prime Minister Theresa May had put forward a proposal to allow what they call a soft exit from the European Union, was roundly defeated, the biggest margin in United Kingdom parliamentary history. She's now facing another vote of no confidence. She might get booted out. We got global disarray now.
That's right. You know, the British only have, something like 70 days as of this week to figure out how to leave the EU, and they've got themselves into quite a mess. So, Jay, which government is more dysfunctional, the US or the UK? They're operating at least, right? They're negotiating at least.
Right, yeah, you can flip a coin there. They may not know kind of which direction, but at least they know where the end is.
They know what they have
inside
to do. Well, we know what we have to do too, and yet it's not happening. So maybe we're more alike than we think.
Well, Brandon, if you think Donald Trump and the British people are having a bad week, there's lots of questions in the air, but one thing we know for sure. It turns out Congressman Steve King is an unabashed racist.
Yeah, this has been a long time coming, Jay. Steve King, who's a representative from Iowa, one of the representatives from Iowa, is facing a political storm because of inflammatory comments he made about race and immigration. Essentially, he questioned why it was the case that the terms white nationalist and white supremacist were offensive now. The party has, I think, done pretty good work at shutting him down. They stripped him of committee assignments, which is a sort of bread and butter for many members of Congress. Mitch McConnell has said he should find another line of work. His hometown newspaper, the Des Moines Register, has said he should resign for the good of the party. Mitt Romney has come out and said essentially he should step aside. So really, it's the case that the GOP has done, I think, a lot. Maybe not as much as they could. They could fundamentally kick him out of Congress by not seating him, but they have been very reluctant to do that in historical terms. So I don't know what more they can do except just to condemn this with the highest amount of consternation.
Yeah, there's been lots of condemnation. Lots of people have criticized him. As you said, Mitt Romney was sort of emerging as the conscience of the GOP.
Yeah.
He's basically telling him he needs to go resign immediately and let the people of Iowa pick someone that better reflects the values of Iowa and the country. The person who has been stone cold silent in this has been the president of the United States, Brandon. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what happened in Charlottesville, where you had neo-Nazis marching in the streets. You have unabashedly racist comments by a member of Congress. And the president, when asked about it, says he wasn't following the issue.
Yeah, I think this is the case that the president's win coalition here for Republicans is minimizing quickly. It's not an issue-specific thing, but rather a kind of tone thing. So this is going to be, I think, an issue for the president and for the White House when they choose to legislate, if that ever comes. But it's not the end of the troubles for the Trump administration. This week, we have a report that a federal judge has essentially ruled that the Trump administration cannot put a question about citizenship status on the 2020 census. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's sort of this ongoing debate as to whether or not you should specifically ask for citizenship status when you go through the census process. The Constitution mandates that every 10 years, a census of the people will be taken. And the reason this is an important issue is that there's a recognition that if the question is asked, it will lead to sort of a chilling effect on people that aren't United States citizens, especially in sort of the broader climate. The judge in the case essentially argued that this language related to citizenship was an insert put in at the last minute and was not what they call field tested. So there was no impact made in terms of whether or not it would have any negative or positive effect in terms of people responding, which is customarily what needs to be done. Because this was injected in at the last minute, the judge says you can't do it. And now we're not going to have this question asked. And it's probably a great thing, especially for more border states, states with high immigrant populations.
Well, it's a temporary win, though, right? Because it's likely to get appealed. And so we're going to see more of this as it worked its way up the court system. But you're exactly right. There are cities that are going to be tremendously disadvantaged because analysis from think tanks of the community survey, which is essentially the census, updates to the census, shows that Latinos, Asians, young people, and urban residents are more likely to be undercounted and therefore underrepresented in Congress. But it's not just that. It's also about the kind of services that government's going to provide. So those kind of things are dramatically affected by this. But to me, there's a bigger issue here. And this is the issue that we've talked about a lot. And that is that the White House simply cannot get its ducks in a row. The ruling was fairly narrow, right? It said essentially that this was, like you say, an arbitrary addition. They didn't follow proper administrative procedures. This is something that probably the White House could win on if they made a good argument, but they aren't and they haven't. So, again, we see a disorganized White House leads to policy failure.
Well, one of the ways the White House is hoping to kind of solve this problem is get their Justice Department house in order. Mm. And the leader of that Justice Department, of course, is the Attorney General. The president has put forth for nomination and confirmation William Barr, who himself was a former attorney general. By all accounts, is very well respected and is kind of the lawyer's lawyer. He may be dull as dishwater, Brandon. I don't know if you saw any of the confirmation testimony. He looked like he was falling asleep himself, and he was putting everyone to sleep
right
around him. But he reconfirmed that he would wants to see the Mueller investigation move forward, and he under no circumstances wants it to end. He wants to make it public, and you know, is doing this to essentially sort of help the department kind of regenerate itself. He sees himself as somewhat independent from the president. It was kind of a whole series of surprising testimony. We'll see how successful he is.
It was a bit of a change from past nominees who had been much more kind of strident in their defense of the president or of executive power. I think that Barr's confirmation shows that essentially he was trying to play to the senators, and I took him at his word. I mean, he has suggested that he thought that Mueller would not be involved in a witch hunt. He flatly said that he would make the report public, which was something a lot of Democrats were worried about. He said that he thought that if it was the case that the president had offered to pardon somebody in exchange for some kind of promise not to incriminate the president, that that would be a crime. So he gave the Senate the answers that they wanted. He came off as a no-nonsense member of the cabinet. In any case, I think it's going to be, despite how boring he clearly is, he's the kind of guy you want as your lawyer, but you don't necessarily want at your dinner party, right? But regardless of all of that, the Republicans are unified behind him, and the Democrats don't have the votes to stop him. So one way or another, he's going to be the attorney general. But I think he gave enough credibility here to make it a good confirmation for the president.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, he seemed like a solid nominee and eminently confirmable, a very un-Trump-like choice.
Yeah, very calm and, yeah, very boring, which is what, frankly, nominees should do if they want to get, you know, confirmed.
Brandon, you know what's not boring is the impending apocalypse that will be the 2020 Democratic primary.
Can we stop it or anything?
Yes, we've already got half a dozen candidates come in. We've gotten two more. Another third is to be expected. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from the state of New York both announced they were running for president. And we've got Kamala Harris from California, who is likely to announce around MLK holiday weekend. We've got a lot going on here. Brandon, what are your thoughts on this? Three women in, which is three more than most Democratic primary elections.
That's true, actually. Well, how long have we been podcasting? For maybe, 13, 14 minutes? And I think we already have probably a handful of more Democrats who have decided to jump into the race. So it's going to happen a lot more. Everyone's got their sights set on Donald Trump. Representative Gabbard, I think, probably has a lane here. She's viewed as somewhat of a maverick, right? She stepped aside from the DNC so she could endorse Sanders. But there's some, I think, historical problems with her advocating for or against same-sex marriage. Senator Gillibrand is an interesting case. Actually, the digital ad she put out is pretty good. If you've seen it, she emphasized being a mother and transparency, taking on Trump, no corporate donations. So she speaks the language, I think, of these Democrats, and especially those who I think are looking for kind of the theme of compromise and accountability to be back in fashion. But I'm going to ask you about this. What do you think about the leak of Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota? There apparently was discovered in a DC coffee house this logo for a possible Amy Klobuchar run for president. She's denied it, but I don't know, the intrigue is swirling.
I fully expect Amy Klobuchar to get in the race. I think she's an interesting candidate. I think she probably leapfrogged these two, especially Minnesota is geographically very close to Iowa. She's a Midwest person, mm-hmm. and the Midwest has been sort of the area that folks have looked at as far as for Democrats. Not nearly as flashy as some of the other folks running. The ones for me, I think they'll make it interesting, is whether or not you see one of what I call sort of the big three candidates, Biden, Sanders, and decide not to run, and that opens up a lane for someone else to come in, especially Biden and Sanders, because everyone is kind of either of the Biden tree or the Sanders tree in this race. You've got sort of that establishment lane, or you've got the very progressive lane, and so that's the question to me is to kind of where you're going to try to run.
Well, Beto's going to be on Oprah Live in Times Square. Maybe he'll have something to announce.
That sounds tailor-made for an announcement.
That's big stage. It was Obama style, right? Remember he announced during the NFL football playoffs 1 year. So, hey, history could repeat itself here.
Well, Brandon, there's a lot of reasons to dislike Donald Trump. A lot of reasons to like Donald Trump, depending on your perspective. But one thing's for certain, his taste in fast food is just plain awful, Brandon.
Right. So what Jay is referring to is that the national champions, the Clemson Tigers, congratulations, winning the college football playoff. They visited the White House this week, and the president unveiled on them a smorgasbord of delights from fast food companies all across this great nation. McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, Domino's. A few notable things missing, right? But there's certainly something for every college student to like, right?
Yeah, it was the most, we joke a lot about this, that the president tries to kind of push back on the Obamas. If there was a meal that was more anti-Barack and Michelle Obama, it was a collection of fast food that was all from some of the worst fast food, like health violators in the country. My thing is this. Leaving aside from the fact that he decided to get takeout and his go-to was fast food, the choice of fast food was ridiculous. McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, and Domino's.
Wow.
You know, my first reaction, what happened to Chick-fil-A? That's right in his lane, kind of crazy right-wing chicken sandwich.
Papa John's, too, right?
Another one that's had a run of problems, kind of the choice of Steve King, shall we say?
Right, that's right. Yeah.
And of course, now we understand Taco Bell because, you know, he probably couldn't get over that large wall in order to get, and he probably couldn't get Mexico to pay for the tacos.
That's funny. Oh, I feel my cholesterol rising already, no matter what.
But as Texans, Brandon, I'm upset. I know where you're probably upset. How could you do a meal of all fast food and not have Whataburger?
No, Whataburger, right? I have to say, this is probably the most bizarre thing I've seen in the presidency, and I've studied presidents that, like, all the way back to the founding, and I have never seen something so bizarre, and so I'm glad to see it. You know, we're in a new territory here, so we'll see. Maybe he'll be more inclusive next time, maybe some salads, although there were salads there, actually.
Yes.
If you see some of the, little to-go salads, he did have some, but... Yeah, it was definitely a carb-rich meal for the visiting Clemson Tigers.
Well, let's shift gears, talk a little bit of Texas. We talked a little bit of Whataburger. That makes me think about the Texas legislature.
Makes me hungry.
Yeah, well, we've got a lot going on. The Texas House, the Texas Senate, we talked about this before. No, the number one issue coming out of the box was going to be public education, reforming school finance here in Texas, kind of the Gordian knot of all things here in Texas. Mm-hmm. And right out of the box, we've already got billions of dollars committed by both the House and the Senate. The Texas House proposed a budget increase of school funding of almost $7 billion. That's billion with a B, folks, $7 billion. And the Senate did about $2.7 billion. And they want to give every teacher in Texas across the board $5,000.
Yeah. I think starting early is important. I mean, the budget is going to be the kind of real sticky wicket for the chambers. They're kind of far apart on this. Not so far apart as maybe a negotiation, you know, between allies couldn't solve, but that's pretty far apart. The House also wants $25 million from the Rainy Day Fund for security equipment. The Senate wants this money. They want $10 million, but not from the Rainy Day Fund. So we're going to see some negotiations over that. Dan Patrick has been really reluctant to use the Rainy Day Fund. So we'll see if they're all singing the same from the same hymnal by April. But as it is now, at least the priorities are similar, even if the numbers are not quite the same.
Yeah, but I'd rather the choice be between spending $7 billion versus spending $2.7
billion,
as opposed to sort of cutting $7 billion and spending
right.
and cutting $2.7
billion. It's not red versus black. It's like they're both.
Yeah,
they're both
it's just degrees of good, as they say. So I think they've got some good options there. Brandon, we were talking earlier about the number of folks running for the Democratic nomination to take on Donald Trump. We've already got history happening here in Texas. Mm-hmm. Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio, a former secretary of HUD in the Obama administration, is announced. Julian 2020 is official. He is running for president of the United States. What's your take? What are his chances?
You know, I think he's probably in pretty good shape. He's young. He's progressive. He's Hispanic. He's got executive experience. He's got some successes to point to. I think he potentially put Texas in play electorally. Or even if he doesn't, it's going to put pressure on Republicans to defend Texas. So that's something I think which gives him a bit of an edge. He also came out this week and said he wasn't going to pardon Donald Trump in case anything goes wrong for him criminally. So he definitely has, I think, a lane he could focus on. But again, it's going to require fundamentals here, right? You got to get staff. You got to get, you know, people in the right places. You've got to get donors lined up. So it's a long haul here, but I think he's in good shape.
Yeah, I think Julian's biggest challenge is just there's so many candidates.
Yes.
There's so much noise. It's so hard to get traction. He announced, and while it was heavily covered here in Texas, it took maybe a half a day before it was off the page and you were on to, you know, other candidates running.
That's
and
a problem,
I think that
part
is hard for him. He's still very much not a known quantity nationally. And I think he competes a lot with, at least nationally, in the minds of folks, with O'Rourke. Now, if O'Rourke doesn't run, I think that it opens up a pretty wide lane for Castro to come in. Mm. Right now, he's definitely, to me, in one of those second or third tier slots.
Yeah. He's on the debate like the second day, the different stage.
Right.
Like,
because,
not the main show, right?
And the challenge for him is, I mean, there's no natural base for him out of, you know, sort of Iowa or New Hampshire. Now, the big advantage he's got the week two thing going on because you've got California and you've got Texas. Super Tuesday is back. You basically have this race can potentially be locked up. If there's no O'Rourke, then it is set up well for Castro if he can stay in till Texas mm-hmm. and California with California's massive number of Latino voters. It's set mm-hmm. up for him. So if he can get there and he can continue on, get a little bit of traction. But again, he needs a little bit of luck and he needs the lane to clear up a little for him.
It's like Jenga. I mean, you pull one part and, you know, some other parts fall, some parts hold. So if Kamala Harris is in the race too, she's going to take a bunch of delegates out of California, but they can split them given the way the rules were written. So yeah, it's going to be a lot and very complicated. Not unlike the way that the party rules on the local level. We had some interesting news this week from Tarrant County. The Tarrant County Republican Party had essentially this week rejected attempts to remove Dr. Shahid Safi from his role as vice chair of the county party for the sole reason that he was a Muslim, and people objected.
Yeah, it turned into a national story because, again, it sort of reinforced this idea about intolerance in the GOP. Thankfully, it was rejected kind of resoundingly. Almost every elected official in and around the state of Texas on both sides roundly rejected it. It's interesting to me, 49 members of the Tarrant County GOP voted in support of rejecting him and kicking him out. And there is an actual bounty on there. I don't want to say it the wrong way. There's a prize given or money given of $500 to anyone that will identify each person, each of the 49. There are folks that really want to go after them and kick them out of the GOP.
Yeah, the sort of, what do they call them, the 49ers. So there's a prize if they can be named. I think they have to increase that amount of money, and I don't think they will, and I don't think that the party is going to give it up. But it's certainly the case that this has been an issue, a national issue. You know, Tarrant County is really the last big urban county, right? We saw it go pretty much 50-50 for Beto in the last election. So this is going to be the case. The Democrats are going to use this against the Republicans and use it to paint them as being extremist. The good news for Republicans is they really kind of came together and said this was not the way that they wanted the party to be governed. But in the short term, the damage is done. So we'll see if long-term efforts towards inclusion can work.
Brandon, another issue that's gotten a lot of national attention are these Confederate plaques and monuments kind of all over the country. Here in Texas, we have them on the Capitol walls. Thankfully, it was finally removed.
We used to.
It was finally removed. State Representative Eric Johnson from the Dallas area had taken a picture, tweeted out. It's finally gotten out of here. It's gotten a lot of national attention. The governor, the speaker, everyone was like, we need to get this out. Thankfully, they did.
Yeah, so this is a plaque that was erected in 1959 as a children of the Confederacy creed, claiming slavery was not the root of the Civil War. We've talked about it a bunch of times. It took them less time to take it down than we've talked about it over the past year. It was about literally 4 minutes. They did the right thing here, and over a quiet weekend in the Capitol, it's now removed.
Well, Brandon, one of the big national celebrities in the Democratic Party is, of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, as she is known, and the group that kind of pushed her forward and kind of helped launch her campaign was an organization called the Justice Democrats. Essentially, they were looking to kind of push out what they think are more moderate to conservative Democrats. Ground zero for them, the number one target for the next cycle is Congressman Henry Cuellar from Laredo. They're coming after him, Brandon. Mm-hmm. What's going on?
Well, he's one of the most conservative members of the delegation, so he's definitely got a target on his back. But it's the case that these kind of things require money and probably some notoriety. So AOC is definitely somebody who can bring that. She's going to be here actually in Austin at South by Southwest. So that'll be an opportunity for her to kind of develop that connection. But this is dangerous territory for the party, right? If you start primarying people in a consistent basis, then you're talking about a real shift in terms of the ideology. It may or may not fit with the governing sort of ethos that happens in Washington, but the Democrats are definitely moving more to the left, so this is in keeping with generally the way things have gone.
Brandon, are you saying you're not down with AOC?
You know me. Speaking of being down with, the Dr. Pepper has been a delightful source of enjoyment and refreshment for so many Texans, Jay. Now, if we can get a Dr. Pepper endorsement out of this, that would be even better. Change.org has issued a petition that is urging the Texas Ledge to declare Dr. Pepper the official soft drink of Texas. Jay, will you sign this pledge?
Brandon, the only mystery to me is how Dr. Pepper isn't already the official soft drink of Texas.
Right.
It was started here in Waco, Texas.
Right.
And I would recommend anyone who wants to go see that museum. It's actually kind of a cool little
tour. It makes you an old school one,
right? Yeah, a little old school. Remember the Dublin Dr. Peppers
and
with
the sugar?
You
can still go to Dublin and get that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm just more surprised that it's not already been done. I mean, we've got the official, bird of Texas and the official, dog of Texas.
The official flying mammal of Texas.
Yeah, I mean, we've got all sorts of nonsensical official things, so how could we not have
this
Dr.
One
Pepper
makes sense,
as the
right?
official? Yeah, I mean, it's obvious.
I love it. I love it. That and Topo Chico. I'd be okay with either one.
Well, Topo Chico,
I drink both by
yeah.
the gallon,
That is a pre-wall drink, Brandon.
Pre-wall.
That is a pre-wall drink.
Right. Well, hey, let's talk Inauguration Day, Jay. So we had a bunch of promises made of a lot of bipartisanship. Both Dan Patrick and Greg Abbott were very much in the spirit of Kumbaya. It reminded me of the Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton duet, The Islands in the Stream, right? I think it's going to be the Islands in the Stream session. What do you think? Is bipartisanship going to last beyond the inauguration week?
Honestly, it's hard for me to get in my mind a picture of Dolly Parton seeing Dan Patrick, but I'll go with you, man.
The Patrick bot brought up Dennis Bonin to share the stage during his inauguration. So there's a bit of a kind of, back and forth there, right?
I think that's a really good point you're making there, because Patrick and Bonin have already got a relationship that he never had with Joe Strauss.
Right.
Bonin's an interesting guy, and I think it's certainly kind of made a difference in creating some of that bond. I was taken by what wasn't said. We'd heard already that the emphasis was going to be on public education.
Yeah.
But what wasn't said was anything related to any of the traditional kind of socially conservative red meat issues
right.
that we've expected out of kind of unified GOP leadership and government over the last 20 years.
Yeah, Dan Patrick, of all people, talking about bipartisanship and how this is going to be the greatest session and how no one talked about how last session there was a bunch of bipartisanship, right? You think it's going to keep going?
That's a great question. I mean, Dan Patrick's big sort of signature element of his speech was about spending $5,000 and giving it to every teacher.
Right.
And it's notable because he was heavily campaigned against by the State Teachers Association and almost lost in large part against an underfunded candidate almost entirely because rural teachers supported him. And this is how we know rural teachers did not support him. In the 175 counties, Mike Collier, the Democrat, outperformed Beto O'Rourke.
Wow.
Because they voted for him against Dan Patrick.
Yep.
Patrick is probably the most disliked politician in Texas now.
I think it's a great point. And this actually affects Greg Abbott too, right? Because they have raised expectations to the point where if this doesn't get done, it's going to be a political problem. On average, it takes like 3 special sessions to get public education reformed. And governors at the end of that always have a target on their back. So this is especially true for suburban areas. So I think the exact phenomenon could transpire in the suburbs and could really hurt Republicans. So the stakes are really high for both of them.
Yeah, I think they recognize that the only chance they have of holding rural Texas and winning back suburban Texas is to focus on public ed and property taxes. And that's what they're doing. That's what they've committed to do. You're not going to see the kind of social shenanigans that you've seen the last few sessions. It wouldn't surprise me if for lack of a better word, this is the most centrist legislative session we've seen in a very long time. I mean, again, we're arguing about spending
right.
either $7 billion or $2.7 billion.
It could also be one of the most expensive, right? Because if you're reforming public ed and, as Governor Abbott said, reining in skyrocketing property taxes, and he said also a line that I think a lot of people missed, which is that he was going to end unfunded mandates to cities and counties, that alone is billions of dollars. So where's all the money going to come from? I don't know. Maybe they can wedge it all in and maybe they can maneuver it around some new structures, but it's going to be, I think, really expensive.
Yeah, I mean, look, we don't have anything resembling some sort of new tax system in place.
Exactly.
So there was no special commission on that. What I suspect will happen is you've got an additional about eight to nine billion based on Glenn Hager's estimates in terms of what they can start with. They've got $15 billion in the rainy day fund. They're probably going to spend a good chunk of that on property tax relief and on public ed. You'll probably see something in between the 7 number and the 2.7, but here's going to be the kicker. You might see some flat increases across the board increases, but you're probably going to see a lot of the education funding, and it's going to be tied to incentives. It's going to be tied to student performance and district performance, and that's something not all teachers and not all school districts back.
That's where the real rub is, right? So we'll see exactly how they do it. That's going to make, I think, the real difference here politically. But hey, Chuck Norris is there. You had Apollo astronauts there. So it's a banner day for Texas. Maybe they can get together to get something done.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer who always makes sure the studio is stacked with French fries, Ernie Manouse. Special kudos to our web and graphics team at HPM. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the Burger King Volslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.